This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast. I'm your host, Ann Nicholson Weber. And today we're going to be talking about the production of Under Milkwood, which is being produced by Caffeine Theater at the Storefront Theater of the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs right downtown. And my guests who are involved in the production are Paul Holmquist, who is the director, Jackie Jackson, who is one of the ensemble members, and Dave Scavarla, who is also one of the ensemble members. So we're going to talk a little bit about the production from the director's and the actor's point of view, and then shift gears a little bit and invite Thomas Dixon, who designed the sound and composed music for the show, to join Paul to talk about that aspect of it. So Under Milkwood is a play by Dylan Thomas, the great Welsh poet of the early 20th century, well, I guess mid-20th century. And as I understand it, Paul, it was written originally as a radio play?
Yes, it was originally written as a radio play and subtitled A Play for Voices. And as I like to joke, was probably not meant to be staged, but had such life and vitality to it. When I was first exposed to it, I really wanted to work on it as a play.
But it has been staged in other productions.
Oh, yeah, many different ways, too, with the different numbers of cast from a one-person show to a cast of, you could have a cast of 50.
So the script does not specify, for instance, who does what narration. There's a lot of narration in there.
Correct. Actually, the narration is broken into two voices that are separate from the characters of the town. Mm-hmm. I chose to split those narrative parts among my cast of nine.
Why did you do that?
I really wanted to keep the audience engaged with the narration instead of sitting back and listening to one person talk for paragraphs on end to liven up the narration a bit by sharing it among the various voices in the cast.
You did something else with the narration I noticed, which was any dialogue is in dialect, but the narration seems to be just kind of in the actor's own accents. Is that right?
Yeah, I wanted the narration to have accessibility to it because the language is so dense and the imagery is so rich. I really wanted it to be accessible to our audience. So while maintaining the honoring the location of Wales and with the character dialects
and the costume
and the costuming, letting the narration be a bridge for the audience.
Which is an interesting effect because the actors are both being people with us in the room. I mean, it clearly delineates them as narrators and as characters. And in some ways, it pulls us back and forth between the world of the town and being in the theater in Chicago in 2009. Did you have a reason to want that effect?
Well, there seems to be something greater going on than just the little scenelets of the characters in the town. With that narration, there's a communion going on with the audience and the performers, the actors, and that was something that I really latched onto early and wanted to bring into this space.
Well, we didn't do a very good job of setting up for a listener who hasn't seen the show exactly what it's like. So I'm going to actually ask Dave and Jackie to pitch in a little bit and just describe very briefly what the play is. Maybe Dave, you start.
What is Under Milkwood? That's an interesting question. Like you said, it started as a play for voices, but it's a glimpse into the secrets and the dreams of the residents of the town of Llareggub, which is bugger all spelled backwards.
Really?
To our delight. Yeah. Mr. Thomas was known for his irreverence, I guess, and that's one of the ways that he used
slipped
it.
In. Well, some of the things that
I ramble and get tangential, and I forget the point of what I was trying to make.
I'm just trying to characterize the piece because it's a very unusual play.
What is this play?
Yeah, so what are the things, Jackie, for you that are the most strikingly different about it than most of the plays you've probably done?
Well, it's a day in the life of a town play. Instead of following a protagonist and a certain person, the audience and the narrators become the protagonists and interact with these other characters, these other people that live in the town of Llareggub. So I think Dave was onto something saying it's their dreams and their secret desires, starting off with their literal dreams at night asleep. And then as you go through the day, you kind of weave in and out of what they say and what they think and what they do and how they interact and all of the different connections that happen in one day, in one small time.
How many characters are there?
47.
That's the number we say.
And
we don't really know.
Nobody's counted.
50.
Yeah. And how many in the ensemble?
9.
And I did want to say that Jackie and Dave are here as proxies for an ensemble. I mean, it's a group piece, and their performances are lovely. But they're not like stars. I mean, it's everybody has.
Oh no, it's all 9 of us. Most of us are on stage for most of the show. I think back. I've been in Chicago theater for a long time, and I've had the opportunity to play lead roles. I've had the opportunity to play juicy supporting roles, and I've had opportunity to be in purely ensemble pieces where every one of us is a cog in this storytelling machine.
Right.
And I think those ones all float to the top somehow for some reason. They've been done by various directors in various techniques.
Mm. That's an interesting observation.
But it is that ensemble effect that I think is one of the characteristics of what is referred to worldwide as the Chicago theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of a mill, that kind of an experience, I think, that gives Chicago actors something real special to be able to participate in those kinds of works.
Well, this is certainly a quintessential ensemble piece. Well, so we've talked about the fact that there's a lot of narration. There's Welsh dialect. But there's also, and there's not a lot of story. It's just little tiny vignettes, little moments. So there isn't what you'd call a dramatic arc to carry an audience through from the beginning to the end of an hour and a half without intermission. The language is it written as verse? On the page as verse?
It's written as prose.
As prose. But it could be verse. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Thomas obviously was first and foremost a poet, and the language is incredibly dense and hard at first for the audience, I think, to absorb. So just address any of those problems. I mean, as you're going into this process, what were you thinking about any of that, and how did you set about to address it?
Well, I started with really focusing on binding the ensemble together. Early staging was really focused on the ensemble having support within the group. Sort of creating a ritual towards the beginning of the piece. As we started bringing audience in and started trading my well-versed ear to a more of a freshman ear to the piece, I noticed that we needed to really invite the audience in. And I think those, you know, they say the first 10 minutes of any play is where the audience kind of settles in, and our first 10 minutes is full of this really dense narration.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to just take a really gentle approach to it, make it a very inviting and warm first 10 minutes, and allow the audience to forget all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just
right.
Forgive any, you know, lack of retention on any of that. And when we go into the first dream, which is Captain Cat's dream, there's this big physical shift, big light shift, and a big sort of stylistic shift, mm-hmm. which then I think provokes the audience to be able to sit back and say, okay, now I'm here. Now I get it. Now
right.
I get it. And I see where
that
we're going. That
was exactly my experience. And there's those first 10 minutes where you think, oh, I don't know if I can do this. This is kind of boring. I can't get into it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly your ear gets acclimated and you figure out how to listen to it. And then suddenly you're off.
Yeah.
So when you said ritual, what did you mean? What were you talking about?
Well, there's something on the overarching part of this play for me that is about the ritual of storytelling and sharing stories, mm-hmm. and even sharing a part of how you share a part of yourself with someone else needs a beginning and an end to it. And for this piece, just having the actors come on stage, look at each other, share a breath before they bring this story to the audience was for me a ritualistic way to sort of begin the piece, to prepare themselves and to prepare the audience for this shared experience.
I see. Well, let's talk. I'd be interested in hearing from Jackie and then Dave what the experience of being an actor in this play was like as compared to something more typical, Sam Shepard or David Mamet or Shakespeare. What were the challenges for you, Jackie?
Well, to start with, the narration being split up, I think that ensemble feel became very important to me, because in the middle of one line written for one person, someone else will pick it up, or you will pick it up from another actor, and there's a lot of give and take and a lot of trust that's absolutely necessary. So learning that trust was not a new thing, because it's in every production,
yeah,
but essential in the beginning of the rehearsal process for this play.
Mm-hmm.
Also, having several different characters to learn and to embody on stage, I think, for my part, I don't know if I can speak for any of the other actors, but for my part, I went with a very basic technical approach, which I don't always do when I have one solid arc of a play to follow and a through line. I went with physicality and voice and just stuck to those two things.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get much more complicated than that. And it seemed to work really well, because how else can you just drop it to mm-hmm. become a voice and a narrator?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they're very lightning quick shifts sometimes. I mean,
yeah,
from one scene to the next year. And Dave, what would you add to that?
Oh, I love the language. It's written as prose, but Shakespeare wrote prose too, didn't they?
Yeah.
And it's dense and rich, and I think we had to approach it like poetry. And use our voices. Use our voices to their fullest. We had an excellent vocal coach and dialect coach in Christina Dare that Paul brought onto the project very early on. And she spent a lot of time with us reconnecting our voices to our bodies, or finding and rediscovering the connections of our voices and our bodies, to give us that re-awareness to bring into rehearsal then, when we were discovering the characters and discovering their physicalities, and because we're playing so many characters each, what their voices are. And how we found those character voices within the dialect. And it was for me, I work a little more organically. So it happened, it sifted out a little more differently for me, because I looked first at all my Captain Cat stuff, which uh-huh. was the lion's share of what I say in the play. And I let myself find my cat voice.
Mm-hmm.
And once I had that voice, I let the verse inform me, I guess. I let what was on the page and the character of the scenes in the different vignettes inform me as to like how these people might be, and mm-hmm. then tried to, sometimes physicality plays into voice and sometimes voice plays into physicality.
Well, try to be
just
more concrete,
organic.
Because for a non-actor to talk about connecting your voice to your body isn't... It's not clear what you mean.
One of the exercises that Christine did that I thought, and this was in maybe our second rehearsal or the second half of our first rehearsal, was she had herself gone through the text and pulled out what she thought were very evocative words.
Hmm.
And she wrote them on cards, and she spread them right on the floor in the rehearsal room. And as we kind of wandered around, wandering around each other, milling about each other, relaxing, finding our breath, letting our breath come,
mm-hmm.
We would then look at one of these evocative words and say it in different ways, say it the way that it strikes you when you first look at it.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost an associative game, you know, how does it sound to you, say it that way, and then mm-hmm. say it some way different, say it until it doesn't make any sense, go mm-hmm. pick up another word
mm-hmm.
and do the same kind of process with it. And I think being relaxed in our physicalities while moving, while working our brains right and left
mm-hmm.
to intone these sounds and to make sense of a word. And then there was another one that she would give us monosyllables.
There was take the word ocean and draw out each of the sounds, oh, shh, and have the entire ensemble kind of just exploring these sounds, not really realizing that they're saying a word until
uh-huh.
they start bringing those sounds together.
Uh-huh.
And the sound makes the sound of the ocean
yeah.
as much as it explains the word. So we were exploring the imagery in these evocative words, and it was really key to start the rehearsal process that way.
Is it onomatopoeia? Isn't that what that is?
Which is also very helpful, because there are words that never come up in our ears
mm-hmm.
in today in life, like snuggeries and pibgorn, and there's a whole dictionary of Dylanisms in this play that just we never say and hear. So to be able to physicalize and vocalize those words mm-hmm. around each other so early on really informed that.
It's interesting because you were describing that process, Dave. What I was thinking is it was as much about, you called it connecting your voice to your body, but to me it sounds like getting words in your body, which somehow seems a little different.
I think that's just another way of
kind of
evoking the same imagery.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's like working backwards, working from the inside out or working from the outside in.
Right.
And sometimes I'll do either, depending on what may be working. But yeah, you can start with words or you can start with emotion and see what words come or see what emotion the word that you're working on brings out that might be a surprise. And I think those early exercises really help us set a tone for discovery inside the rich imagery and the dense language and made up words that he liked. You know, had great fun playing with language, and it's modern language, but it's poetic modern language.
Yeah. And a lot of it very unfamiliar, as Jackie said. Well, and it seems to me that in a sort of more typical dramatic work, actors spend a lot of time on motivation and kind of understanding subtexts in these interchanges and so forth. And that doesn't strike me as being a very big part of what you would have been thinking about. Is that true or not true? Not true. You're both kind of going,
Because it's written in the text and we speak it in the text. And I'm going to use the scene with the pews as an example. There are two characters, the pews. Mr. Pew wishes to murder his wife by poisoning her. And it's very obvious because we say Mr. Pew wants to poison his wife in so many words in many different ways.
Uh-huh.
And we describe his inner monologue and his inner motivations and all of the things that he's thinking and all of the things he's saying, he says. But then there are these long passages of narration of what's going on up here in
his interior life, right?
Yeah. So for that, for Paul, the actor who plays Mr. Pew, he doesn't need to do the work. It's already done.
Right, right. I guess in a way that's what I meant, that there wasn't a lot of mystery to unpacking what's going on in their interior lives because a lot of it is made explicit. Mm-hmm. So then I would imagine it becomes about something else. And I'm wondering, because the other thing I wanted to talk about is the movement in the play. We've talked some about the language, but the movement is also very stylized and choreographed throughout, really. Why did you do that?
Well, I wanted to keep the play moving, but I love the stage pictures and the possibilities on the set has a lot of there's all these different levels and ramps and stairs and things and so I wanted to have a sense of a real location when we were with the characters that could easily just dissipate and fly away at a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. Characters will move around the set and land in certain places that all of a sudden establishes place.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted the ensemble, you know, as Dave mentioned, they rarely leave the stage. And I wanted the ensemble to become part of the set at times or part of the environment. Mm-hmm. So they become tea kettles or they become cows or clocks in various scenes. So that mm-hmm. was part of the engulfing sort of effect that I wanted for the ensemble to take over the whole story and all aspects of the story when bringing the audience along with them mm-hmm. on this sort of imaginary journey.
So it's movement, it's voice, we talked about that, it's the way you use the ensemble and switch the narration around. I'm sort of listing the strategies that you've mm-hmm. mentioned to deal with the particular problems of this text. There's one scene, there are a couple scenes that stayed with me particularly. One of them is Captain Cat, who is blind and is listening to the town. And there's a long scene where he's deciphering the action in the town by listening. And first, I just wonder if you have anything to say about that scene, because it's really stood out for me.
It's like an aria, actually. It's mm-hmm. it's like singing a lead, because there's lots of musicality of the language.
Lead,
it is
L-E-A-D,
singing a lead role, singing an operatic aria.
Uh-huh.
So while there's something epic about the size of it, it's it's really kind of small. This guy's sitting by himself. He's been blind for a while, enough to get to the bar on his own, you know,
right.
enough to get around the town on his own. But he doesn't have to. He knows where everything is. He knows who everybody is by their voices, by the cadence of their walk. And it's like theater of the mind. It's because I'm not looking, I'm listening, and I'm listening to what's going on around me, and I'm listening to myself say it as if it were a radio play, trying to put it into the heads of the audience.
Well, there was another thing I just wanted to mention, because as I said, and as you acknowledged, it takes a while for the ear of the audience to get fully acclimated and be able to follow. And then even so, it's effort. You really have to listen hard the whole hour and a half. And it occurred to me during that scene, Captain Cat narrating, that having a blind character who's living by his ears brings that out in the audience. I mean, suddenly there's a quality of listening that we pick up because you're listening that way in this character, this blind character. So I just thought, boy, Dylan Thomas is really smart.
Well, I like it too. It's I love performing live, but it's like live empathic vibrations. And if you can hit the right tone and bring the audience in, and it's, you know, everything that happens before I get to that part is getting them ready for it. And then they're entirely prepared by the ensemble's work to come with me.
And see it in our mind. And that raises another question, is how did you have to make choices about what to stage and what not to stage?
Yeah, there were a few, there were some cuttings made. Mm-hmm.
Well, I meant specifically, you can just say it or you can show it also.
Oh.
Enact it.
Yeah, I really wanted to be careful to not overstage the piece.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to distract from the language and from the text.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some aspects of Cat and Cat at the Window that are staged, where he hears the women at the pump, and I have a small gathering of women there. But then there are other people walking by that he mentions that I don't have
walk across
stage,
the stage. And the kids, the children are big in that. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And then there's one more element, which is the song. And one of the reasons I wanted to include Jackie is because her character, Polly Garter, who is my other favorite character, sings a lot and is characterized a lot by her music. And I wondered, well, we're going to talk to Thomas, the sound designer and composer, in a minute about that. But I wondered if you had anything to say about how bringing music in, singing in, when you're already essentially speaking verse, how that worked or felt, or anything you want to say about it.
It felt pretty natural because the character of Polly Garter, I'd say she's more characterized by how many children she has. She has a lot of babies. And I used to work in a nursery and dealt with babies, and lots of babies, a lot. And one of the things that you do with babies is you sing to them, because sometimes the bottle isn't the problem, the diaper isn't the problem, burping isn't the problem. It just needs a human to interact with. You know, every baby just kind of needs some warmth and affection. And so also Polly Garter, in addition to having lots of babies, has had lots of lovers. And one in particular stands out in her mind, and she carries that lover's image with her wherever she goes, because he died. So while singing with the babies, there's also this who is singing to the babies. It's not, it becomes not about the babies. It becomes about the song and about Polly's lost love. And like, even though the baby is on stage, even though I'm holding the baby and clearly singing to the baby,
and
I'm
by the
singing
way,
to myself.
One of the most convincing blanket babies I ever saw. That's so hard to do well. And you really did. I'm sorry I interrupted you, because you were,
that's okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a natural segue to bring Thomas in and talk about the music. So thank you both, Jackie and Dave, for joining
Excellent.
Us. Well, Paul, one more thing I wanted to ask you is whether the audition process was different for you because of this unique qualities of this text.
Yeah, every audition process is really different for me, for the shows that I direct. And for this, I selected three male, three female cuttings and asked actors to come in with two favorites.
Mm.
And And they were simple pieces, but did show the density of the language. So for me, it was a combination of can the actors handle this kind of text, and can they do something interesting with it? Mm-hmm. And then I took all the headshots, the resumes and pictures of the actors home with me and mulled over casting for about a week and a half, 2 weeks. I didn't know how many actors I was going to cast going into it. I was thinking somewhere like 8 to 12 people. Uh-huh. Then it was kind of percolating on those faces, and many of these people I know very well, mm-hmm. and worked with before. So I have to say, though, that Dave Scavarla, I did ask him to play Captain Cat before I held any auditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see why. So Thomas Dixon has joined us, and he is the composer and sound designer for the show.
Actually, not the composer.
Oh.
I didn't write any music for the show. The songs you hear in the show are included in the script. The sheet music is included with the script.
No, I don't know where I got that.
In the program, I'm listed as the composer.
Ah.
That's what I was contracted as.
But in the end,
I see.
Well, that makes me feel better. I didn't make it up. Well, let's talk about the sound design, because one of the things that, well, first of all, as I said before the interview, there were a few moments. Some of the peak moments for me actually were in the sound design. And again, I imagine my reaction to it had to do with the fact that one's listening becomes so acute as an audience member in this show, because you have to listen so hard. And so somehow I felt like I was more sensitive to sounds than maybe I might always be. There's one moment, for instance, where Polly Garter is scrubbing a floor, and she takes a rag and puts it into a non-existent bucket, and we hear this wonderful sloshing sound, and then she scrubs, and I can't explain to you why that was so magical to me. Do you know why it was so magical?
I do not know why that is so magical, but I find it magical too. A friend of mine who saw the show, actually her one comment for me about the show was, how did you make that bucket noise?
Like, how did you make that bucket noise?
It's pretty simple. It's a recording of a rag in a bucket,
uh-huh.
that Jackie, the actor playing Polly Garter, she throws her rag in the bucket, and we play the sound of the bucket. And
it's perfectly coordinated. I think if it were even for a second off, it would be annoying. But
that's a combination of our stage manager calling the cue
right.
at the time that she does, and the actress just working her self to bits to make that happen.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Right. Well, what it raised for me is the soundscape that you create for the town when you're dealing with a poetic text where there's a lot of music in the language. I mean, we were talking before about the onomatopoeia of some of the words and so forth. I imagine you had to think hard about how much sound to use and where to use sound. You didn't make every sound that's mentioned in the text, did you?
No. From the first moment I signed on to this production, there was one paragraph in the text that was so intimidating. It's probably 8 sentences long, just listing different sounds around the town.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought from the beginning, well, there's no way we're going to hear all of those. That would be like the comedy hour. So I tried really hard to be pithy with the sounds I used and cut to the chase about what sound would emotionally make the audience more receptive to what was going on stage.
And is that just instinct? Is there anything you can say about how you make that decision?
It's very instinctive for me.
Uh-huh. You just say yes, that, no, not that.
Yeah.
How about talking a little bit about the scene we already discussed, Captain Katz listening to the town?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess that you actually did do everything that he...
I would say about 50% of that is the live actors on stage,
uh-huh.
and then there are some sounds, like there's a dog barking, and there's the sound of high-heeled shoes going by.
And the children.
And the children,
uh-huh.
of course.
Uh-huh.
So that section, I think, is a pretty collaborative realization of the text there.
And how much, when you're working with a director to address something like that, do you make decisions and bring them to Paul? Does Paul give you dictates? How did that happen?
I think the way Paul and I worked is I came in with things, and he said no, or he said, why don't we do this? Mm-hmm. When we started tech, there was a lot more sound in the show,
uh-huh.
And we cut a lot.
Was there anything he cut that you were mad at him about?
There were a few things. We don't need to go into them.
Because you loved them so much, or because they were so hard to do?
Because I loved them, but not for reasons of the show's integrity. I loved them for reasons of my own creativity.
Right. Look how smart I was.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
So they were good cuts in the end, I think.
You ended up being persuaded. That's painful, though. Well, did you have to think about how dense the text was, for instance? Did you have to worry about distracting from the text?
That's what a lot of our tech process was, I think, sound-wise. We started with a lot more sound at the beginning of tech, as I said, and just sort of chopped things here and there as we went. Every day, there were probably about 10 cues that got cut.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the tech process was just cutting to the chase and really focusing the audience on what was happening.
It's difficult, I think, to you want to focus the ear, and you also want to give the ear a rest.
Mm-hmm.
It was just kind of walking that line of what's too much and what's just right, and mm-hmm. what do we love, and what babies can't we kill that we just have to keep.
Right, right, you know? Right, right. Is there any, the show, because it's set in a very specific time and place, has a flavor. This Welsh town has a really strong flavor. Is there any way that you had to find a version of a sound that had that character?
The first thing that comes to mind is finding a good ambient street noise for the town.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the pre-recorded sound effects that are available when you look for a street have a lot of cars in them.
Uh-huh, right.
And we definitely didn't want a lot of cars. So I think I ended up using something recorded in Zaire.
Huh.
That's the noise of the street, which sounds like an awful idea, but it works out.
And then the water sounds. Doesn't the show begin with just the sound of water?
Yes. That,
of the waves lapping, right. Well, I guess the thing that made me want to talk to you and the reason that I feel that your sound design was so successful has to do with the fact that this show is so much about the ear. And, Paul, your point about how you balance feeding us enough, but without making it so distracting, because we're working so hard to hear the language. So I just want to say I think you did a great job in hitting that balance.
Thank you very much.
So the show runs until?
September 27th, so there's 12 more performances.
Great. Well, I hope people will come as a result of listening to this, because it's a show that deserves to be seen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.